Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues produced by the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The Haug Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, a podcast on mental health issues. I'm your host, Ike Evans. Today, we're going to be looking at racial disparities and the COVID-19 pandemic.
I would say that it certainly hit some communities harder than others, both in terms of the health impact and in terms of the economic impact. We've seen in city after city, for example, how African Americans have had higher infection rates, often higher death rates. That's true for Latinos in some cities. It also seems to be impacting the poor much more harshly.
The voice that you just heard belongs to Representative Joaquin Castro, one of our guests for this episode. In Texas, state elected officials are pressing Governor Greg Abbott to form an emergency task force to examine racial disparities amid the coronavirus pandemic, as several Texas cities report that the disease is disproportionately affecting African American residents. The data on racial disparities is patchy, but the data that we do have seems to suggest that blacks are disproportionately likely to be hospitalized and to die from COVID-19. A new study conducted by epidemiologists and clinician researchers from six organizations and universities across the country found that counties with high rates of African American residents comprised 52% of all diagnoses and 58% of all COVID-19 deaths nationally. According to an analysis by American Public Media Research Lab, African Americans, despite making up 13% of the U.S. population, are 27% of known COVID-19 deaths in Michigan. In preliminary data released in early April, African Americans made up 14% of the state's population, but accounted for 33% of the COVID-19 cases and 41% of deaths. In New York City, more than 2 in 1,000 Black and African American residents have died of COVID-19. More than 2 in 1,000 Hispanic and Latino residents have died of the virus. These are rates that are substantially higher than those seen in the city's white and Asian populations. This points up the need for even more data, but such data as we do have strongly suggests that this pandemic has a disproportionate effect on African Americans on the economic front, in the severity of the virus's symptoms, and in the racial disparity of its treatment. Now, this comes as no real surprise to those who approach issues through a health equity lens, which brings us to our two guests. Octavio N. Martinez Jr. is the Executive Director of the Haug Foundation for Mental Health and Senior Associate Vice President for Diversity and Community Engagement at the University of Texas at Austin. He is also a clinical professor at the UT School of Social Work and professor of psychiatry at Dell Medical School. He is joined by Joaquin Castro, who represents Texas's 20th Congressional District, which covers a large portion of San Antonio and Bexar County. Now in his fourth term in the U.S. House of Representatives, he serves on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, as well as the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Education and Labor Committee. Representative Castro, Dr. Martinez, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ike.
And just so everyone knows, like pretty much it seems the rest of the world, we're having this conversation via Zoom. I will do my best to spruce up the audio, but if it's less than perfect, that's largely the reason. So my first question is that it's fashionable to say that the coronavirus doesn't discriminate, but the pandemic as a social phenomenon certainly seems to be. So even with everything that we're still learning, what can we say about the disparate impact of COVID-19?
I would say that it certainly hit some communities harder than others, both in terms of the health impact and in terms of the economic impact. We've seen in city after city, for example, how African Americans have had higher infection rates, often higher death rates. That's true for Latinos in some cities. It also seems to be impacting the poor much more harshly. And, you know, people who work in certain places that are often, I think, forgotten sometimes by our country, the farm workers in the fields, people working in all these meatpacking plants where there have been explosions of infections. So it really has exposed a lot of the underlying inequities in American society.
And I can thank you, Representative Castro. I totally agree with everything you just said. And what I would add to that, Ike, from a mental health standpoint, there are also other communities and groups of individuals that are being impacted unjustly. In addition to the ones Representative Castro laid out, we also should be thinking about like our homeless populations, where we already knew and know that the individuals with dealing with a really severe mental illness are overrepresented. And that is also true of, unfortunately, of our jails, prisons, our incarcerated folks. We also already knew, and COVID-19 is exacerbating how they are being affected as well as being treated and having access to the resources that we so woefully need for everyone. But our jails and prisons, unfortunately, have become, you know, by de facto, the largest psychiatric institution in this country, and they're being affected greatly. As well as our institutionalized folks, those that do need to be taken care of in a state mental health facility, for example, how do they respond and how do we ensure in keeping their safety? And once again, if you peel back and take a look at who is overrepresented just in general in these mental health populations dealing with severe mental illness like, you know, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or major depressive disorder, you know, once again, it's unfortunately individuals who don't have access to health insurance, so therefore uninsured or underinsured, as well as individuals who are affected by a whole host of social determinant factors. And that results in, as Representative Castro pointed out, economic, but also health and mental health issues all coming to bear on these populations.
And so the accounts and perspectives of those who have the ability to work from home seem to dominate the discussion. So what can we do to make sure that this crisis is represented, understood, and when it's over, remembered from all perspectives?
Well, I do think that it's important in the reporting of this pandemic and its effect on the country that the voices of people who are still out there working that don't have the ability to stay home and stay safe in the same way, that their accounts are recorded both for history and also so that we can learn the lessons from them about what needs to change in terms of policy. You know, you think about the challenges of that, the fact that you don't have as many reporters going out and doing person on the street interviews, for example, because of social distancing. I think it's been harder in this period to get the perspective of people who are in those meatpacking plants and facing coronavirus infections. As I watch television, I see, including myself, interviews with people that are in their homes. But there's a large segment of American society that doesn't have the ability to stay home. Their job requires them to go out and work. And I also think that those folks should get hazard pay, for example, from their company or their government. But this period, I hope, will be a period that we're able to look back on as a unique period, or at least one of the unique periods in American history. In the same way that as somebody that was born in 1974, I look back on video or photos of the long gas lines of the gas shortage in the early 1970s and look at it as a kind of anachronism. But it's going to be important that as we look back on this period, that all of the perspectives are represented.
You know, that's so true. And it's going to be a challenge, Ike, because for those that that are working from home, and that's about as I understand from the studies and such, that about, you know, one out of three Americans are able to work from home, and that's a real privilege. And you know, the Hogg Foundation staff, myself, we fall in that category. But that means that 70%, as Roberto Castro's pointing out, are not, and if they're still having to work. And it's such a, we have now a service industry economy, and they're considered to be essential workers. They don't have a choice but to be out there and to capture their perspective, their account of what's happening, their fears, their traumas, I think is so important. But we can't leave out, as I mentioned earlier to the other question, Ike, is our homeless populations and those that are institutionalized or incarcerated. But also I would add, we can't forget about our retired populations and our elderly and how this is impacting them. And to stay at home, to shelter in home, shelter in place, as they've told us to, for appropriate, you know, public health reasons, can lead to and increases isolation and loneliness. And that has a huge impact on our elderly and population. But it also has an impact on entire family structures as well, that we need to ensure that we take into consideration as we look toward the future of how do we stay connected? How do we maintain our humanity in a moment of crisis, especially one of this magnitude, and that one that will have ongoing sequelae? You know, it's not just going to end with, you know, going over and flattening the curve and then coming off the other side. We will be dealing with these issues for years to come. And there will be, unfortunately, crisis in the future. And I'm with Representative Castro. I hope this gets, you know, captured and we learn from it, because if not, we will end up unfortunately repeating some of our same mistakes. And that is one thing that I worry about. I don't know about you, Representative Castro, but it's something that's been on my mind recently.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's ironic because you do have a big percentage of the workforce that's still out there working. You see sanitation workers, grocery store workers, healthcare workers. And right now, a big danger for them is incurring the infection, the coronavirus infection. It's a physical danger. But you also have a lot of people who are at home who are suffering from anxiety, from feelings of isolation, from depression. So this virus has impacted people, not only those who become infected, but also because of the measures that we've had to take, people who have been at home now for several weeks. And what do we learn from that going forward? I think one big lesson that a lot of people will take from this, for example, for policymakers, is that the healthcare system that we have now, which is employer-based healthcare, has got to change. Because now that you've got 28 or 29 million people out of work in the last month, most of those people who are now out of work no longer have healthcare coverage, or maybe trying to roll over to COBRA, which is very expensive. I think that's why you see proposals for Medicare for All go up to 69% support, or certainly support for universal healthcare coverage. I'm interested as a policymaker to see what we take from this and what we start to change.
Boy, you know, that's so true. It also makes me think of our small business owners and our independent individuals who are out there in the gig economy. And they're not able to, because of the current infrastructure we've developed with employer-based healthcare, to be able to afford the insurance plans that exist out there. The Affordable Care Plan was trying to make some inroads, but it still needed, some additional, ongoing, adjustments to our economy. But that's sort of come to a standstill under this current administration. But it begs the question, and you brought it up, and really makes me think about it, Representative Castro, how do we ensure the health of our citizens, be they employed or they're the family members or the unemployed, to be able to continue to be really responsive to our health? But, you know, our health is so important for so many different aspects of being a society. You're in a lot of great committees. It makes me think of, you know, if we don't take care of our health, how can we continue to take care of ourselves from a security standpoint, is just an example.
No, I absolutely agree.
Okay, so I was hoping that, you know, both of you could maybe share just, you know, some of what you've been hearing from either, you know, constituents or stakeholders that really help to enrich or even complexify our understanding of COVID-19 and the impact that it's having.
Yeah, I think people were hit with two things at once. I mean, they were hit by the fear of becoming infected with a virus that's been proving deadly. And at the same time, a lot of people were suddenly out of work. So there was both this fear of the infection and an economic fear that I think hit people all at once. And as a congressman in San Antonio, my staff and I saw that very closely, because we were getting people calling pretty much in a panic. And what I also saw is, besides the healthcare system, which is not set up to deal with a situation like this because it's employer-based, other systems were clearly not designed for this volume of a problem. For example, on the economic front, suddenly there were millions of people that are out of work. In Texas, more than a million people. And those folks were trying to get economic unemployment benefits. And people were calling 100 times, 200 times, trying to get into the Texas Workforce Commission to get their claim processed, with no success. And so for government, it's been a lesson in how you go back and redesign systems really to account for an unexpected emergency, and really, you know, to function better. And in some places, quite honestly, some of these systems were built not to help people who are in need. In Florida, for example, there was a story about critiques of their unemployment system and the fact that they made it hard for people who are unemployed to actually get unemployment benefits, because there's been this notion that people are somehow, through their own laziness, responsible for their unemployment. Well, so what happens all of a sudden when you have millions of people that are out of work? What do you do with those folks when it's clearly not anybody's fault? And so, you know, it's been a real lesson here in Texas for us.
And Ike, let me add a different kind of perspective that, as you pointed out, to stakeholders that we're in touch with and constituents. So being the executive director of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health, stakeholders and constituents I'm involved with are more of, you know, in the world of philanthropy. And one of the things that, in addition to what's happening, you know, on the ground, and I think Representative Castro has really captured that, what's happening to our communities and to individuals, is what's also happening, though, when you think about organizational structure and leadership. So there have been ongoing discussions. And how do you also, during a crisis, provide support? And we mustn't forget the impact on, say, the executive directors and the CEOs of philanthropic organizations and nonprofits, where all of a sudden, you know, their staff is affected, them themselves or their family is being affected by COVID-19, their constituents, their customers, for better lack of a word. And so it's what's happening with this crisis, it's hit it in every level. And in that sense, there's multiple layers that need to be working in unison and together to be able to provide good opportunities as well as resources for all. It also makes me think of one of the areas that we have not invested as well in. And in fact, in some cases, some states have disinvested, including, in my opinion, the federal government, is our public health infrastructure. And that has come to bear and has shown now the gaps and the challenges of how do we address a crisis when our public health infrastructure has really been really minimized over the decades. And I want to, Representative Castro, there's some great, I'm hoping, some good discussions happening, as well as ideas and plans and strategies of how, when looking forward, what do we need to do to, in fact, ensure we have a good public health infrastructure, not only at the federal level, but even at the state and county level, because, you know, that's multi-level, right? And they all should be working, in hopefully in unison, But I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, no, that's right. And the first step of that is, of course, I'm chairman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. You also have KPAC, which is the Asian American and Pacific Islander Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, and then a Native American Caucus. And we've joined together because we're going to work with some researchers on exactly the question of health disparities during this pandemic and what it has exposed or brought to the surface. And then from there, a prescription going forward for policymakers on how you start to change those things. In other words, what do you do in the area of healthcare, housing, economic development and jobs or the workforce, all of these things for vulnerable populations who have been made more vulnerable during this pandemic. So we've just gotten that going now, and it's gonna be a months long process. But I do think that for policymakers, both at the federal, state, and local levels, that it will bear fruit, I think, once we can get it done. And certainly for us in the Congress, we intend to use it as a kind of blueprint on what needs to change.
I think that this is an opportunity for us to come together and to work together and also reach out to the world of philanthropy. There are many good organizations that could partner with and work with and leverage what you've just laid out, like the Wellbeing Trust, obviously the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health itself, but it also makes me think of nonprofits like Trust for America's Health. We are all dedicated to really improving our public health infrastructure, as well as our mental health infrastructure for all, everyone that lives here in the United States.
Yeah, no, and it's been very stark. You know, I got many calls and people reaching out about even basic things like not being able to get tested, not being able to get a mask when they needed one. You know, so from fairly complex things to very simple things, our system in different ways broke down. It just wasn't prepared for this. And we need to really understand exactly what happened. And as much as possible, extract the politics from that to understand what happened so that we don't experience these same shortcomings again.
You know, I totally agree. And it makes me also think of one of the populations we haven't mentioned are really our individuals that are immigrants or undocumented that are here in the United States. And it happened during Hurricane Harvey, and it's happening now with COVID-19. Many of these folks are part of the economic infrastructure, and they're in many cases considered essential employees, but they don't have any of the benefits or the resources to ensure their health. That puts them at risk, but also puts others at risk. And I think we need to really have a comprehensive humanistic approach to understanding the impact of the flow of economies between countries and the impact within the infrastructure, and not really just allow it to continue as it has been, because unfortunately it is just not, the status quo currently is just not working for anyone.
Yeah, no, we've never been completely honest in our country about the fact that there are four or five or more major American industries that would not exist the way they do, would not have been successful the way they are, but for immigrant labor. And some of that undocumented immigrant labor. And so far, I think one of the gravest injustices of what the Congress has done is that many of those immigrants have been completely left out of some of the healthcare relief and all of the economic relief in the legislation that's been passed. And so for example, immigrants will often use, instead of a Social Security number, they'll use what's called an individual tax identification number, ITIN number. So anybody using that ITIN number, anybody using that number was denied any kind of financial assistance. So no $1,200 payment for them, no $500 for their dependents. But it gets worse than that because they were also denied, even if they were married to an American citizen and have American citizen children, they were completely denied any benefits. In other words, the whole family, the spouse who's an American citizen, the kids who are American citizens, the whole family got X'd out of any kind of financial assistance in the legislation that Congress has passed so far. And that's an injustice that needs to be corrected by Congress as soon as possible.
Okay, so that's a perfect jumping off point for my next question. And you touched on some of this, but what promising ideas or initiatives do you see emerging from, you know, from either the world of politics or philanthropy that might begin to address, you know, some of the issues that both of you have raised?
Well, what I've seen is a new legislative ideas for addressing some of our public policy failings. Again, I think moving us away from an employer-based model of healthcare delivery, that's going to be an important one. Also, I think we're moving closer to the idea that healthcare is a human right, that housing is a human right, that educational opportunities are fundamental to everybody in the country. Those have been very promising. For example, in education, the Congress committed more money to close the digital divide between wealthy and poor school districts, or sometimes urban and rural school districts. So that's going to be, I think, a lasting positive from a silver lining from what has happened. I also think that it's created new people and institutions that have stepped up to help in different ways. And I'll give you an example of that. We've spoken during the podcast, Dr. Martinez has, about the homeless. And last year, my brother, Julian, who was HUD secretary under President Obama, was in Las Vegas, and he walked under these bridges that look more like caves, actually, but they're tunnels. And you have a entire homeless population in Las Vegas that's living in these tunnels amidst one of the wealthiest areas in the world, the Las Vegas Strip, with all these, you know, hotels worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And what we've seen is that as these hotels have been empty in different cities, some cities have now started to use those hotels as places where homeless are able to stay, and others have been able to stay. And that is a marked change in how we use our resources. And I understand that this is a very different period, because right now hotel rooms are empty and so forth, but it's using assets that traditionally have not been allowed to that group of people, using them in this time to be helpful. And hopefully we'll start to rethink more things like that.
I think that's a great point that President Castro has made, Ike, and that let me add on to that, in the sense that there have been some challenges we've had, for an example, in really rolling out telemedicine, telepsychiatry, telepharmacy, really the whole use of, you know, broadband and the infrastructure that's needed to be able to provide care outside of the four walls of the clinic, where we can actually do it now, you know, in folks' homes through these new platforms. And we've had challenges that we've basically self-created that haven't allowed us to really expand that. And during this crisis, a lot of those challenges, those rules and regs that were not allowing us to fully implement, have been laid aside to deal with the crisis. My hope is that we've learned from that, that we actually can do this, and that once the crisis is over, however that's defined in the near future, that we don't roll back and go to our pre-COVID-19 infrastructure that was not allowing us to move things forward. As Representative Castro was pointing out, really being creative in identifying the resources we all really do have, and how can we maximize their use for everyone and for specific, you know, groups and populations that are dealing with the issues of, say, homelessness, or maybe they're unemployed, or they're dealing with, you know, a mental health or chronic illness. The other thing that I've seen that is coming to bear is the importance of acquiring data and metrics to be able to truly inform us on how we are doing and what we need to do. And it's already been brought up, you know, the disparities that we're seeing that have popped up in, you know, Chicago, New York, Houston, Miami, in reference to what's happening to our African-American, you know, population, what's happened to our Hispanic and Latinos, Native American population, how COVID-19 is affecting from a morbidity and a mortality standpoint. And yet we don't have good process and ability to gather that data across the board. So there's much we hopefully are learning from this experience of how to do that, and why it is so important to gather that data, why it's important to know your race and ethnicity, why it's important to know, you know, what language you speak or what language you prefer, why it's important to know, do you have access to interest or why you don't. And the list can go on, and because getting to also what Representative Castro said, and I totally agree, hopefully this brings us all to really be thinking about that health, and there is no health without mental health, in fact, is a right and should be a right, and hopefully we can actually move that agenda forward, and it, in my opinion, add it to the Constitution, because health is such an important, critical component of our humanity, to be able to do anything and everything as individuals and as communities and as families.
Okay. Is there anything else that, you know, that either of you would like to bring up while we have you here?
Well, I hope that the Congress, you know, we're still in the middle of this pandemic, and there's going to have to be more relief packages. I hope that will include more funding for mental health and for physical health, but also more economic relief, and that the lessons that we're learning now will not be lost on us, and that they will continue, you know, for many years to come, and the future generations will learn from what we've experienced. Like I said, I hope that people will be able to look back on this the way that I look back on the gas shortage, long lines, and the gas shortages of the early 1970s as a kind of period piece. Even if that's the case, the lessons that we've learned and the policy changes that we make because of this, I think, have the opportunity to be significant and profound for this country.
I think that's spot on, Representative Castro. And I'll end with this. COVID-19 is an unmasker and a revealer of our challenges and our gaps, but it's also testing our resilience. And what I'm hopeful is that we are coming together to be more resilient as a society and really as a world, because this is a worldwide event. It isn't just any one country that is not being impacted by COVID-19. And we need to think about how do we stay resilient, because there are going to be ongoing issues related to COVID-19 we have to deal with in the near future, but even going out a couple of years. We still don't have a vaccine. We're still working on, you know, evidence-based treatments to have into place. But even once we have those on board, we're going to have to then be able to roll those out and be able to adjust and adapt as a society to be able to have a functioning society and one where all of us can still feel, you know, we're a member of it, and that we're not going to be othering or, you know, blaming or pointing a finger at anyone else, because we're all in this together.
Okay. Representative Castro, give our regards to your brother. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your very busy schedule to talk to us. And Dr. Martinez, as always, we are grateful any time that you're able to come onto the podcast and share your insights. So thank you to you both.
No, thank you all. Take care.
Thank you, Representative Castro. Thank you, Ike. You guys were great.
And that brings us to the conclusion of this episode. I have included a list of links to various resources that help to further explain the health equity dimensions of COVID. Once again, this list is not for hoarding. Please share it with everyone you can think of, just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others. So too does it work in reverse. By helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review, subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or TuneIn. Thank you very much.